that is the quickest and most effective way to take animals out in a hurry.
The Board of Game looks at new aerial predator control proposals. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 27th of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lots of stimulus transportation money, but maybe none for Fairbanks.
You know, as this thing unfolds, we're going to try to see what we can do to fix or mitigate that, but it's a high concern.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Grant Station, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com.
The State Board of Game has begun work on a stack of proposals, many of which involve predator control. Among other things, the board is considering allowing citizens to hunt wolves from helicopters and clarifying how killing bears in their dens can be done legally. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
In the various game management areas in South Central and Southwestern Alaska, there are plans to renew existing programs, to expand them, and in many areas, local advisory committees have requested new predator control programs. The board will take as long as necessary, taking public comments on these proposals one by one before beginning deliberations. Everybody's expecting emotions to run high at times. People in many rural areas see bear and wolf predation holding down populations of the moose and caribou they need to feed their families. Defenders of Wildlife has begun a publicity campaign against predator control in Alaska, saying the scientific justification for it has grown flimsier and flimsier, and at this point the board is going overboard. Some proposals are objected to by state enforcement officers, particularly allowing private individuals to kill wolves and bears from helicopters. One proposal would allow the use of helicopters to bait black bears. Then there's the matter of killing predators in their dens. Some videotape of a bloody denning episode on the Alaska Peninsula got out on the internet, and state law enforcement is asking for some clarification on whether this should be legal. Wade Willis of Defenders of Wildlife says this puts the board on the spot.
Well, what they've done is they've never actually addressed a proposal that specifically requested denning. They have never fully vetted the question of is denning appropriate or legal. And since they've never done that and they've never actually cited the regulatory change, then there's a big problem because the Department of Law and the ADF&G both are saying, hey, you guys need to approve this or not. Don't just hint at it. You need to fully address it or don't address it.
The proposals are likely to keep on coming. Greg Rizichka, a former board member who is now the vice chair of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Federal Subsistence Advisory Council, thinks the board is still recovering from having the voters repeatedly slap down aerial wolf control through ballot measures.
Well, I was appointed to the board the year that the ballot initiative went through, and everything was suspended until the National Academy of Sciences report came out.
Rizichka says the National Academy study called for more work to justify predator control, and that work is expensive. He says he's not sure how he feels about private individuals killing bears or wolves from helicopters, but he does think, at least for fish and game personnel, the aircraft do the job.
I mean, when it comes down to it, it's requested the most effective, efficient, and humane, and that is the quickest and most effective way to take animals out in a hurry.
The proposals run well in excess of 300 pages, and while not all of them involve predator control, a surprising number of them do, including easing the requirements for what hunters have to do for reporting and not wasting after killing predators. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
A bill read into the state Senate today would set up a special task force to deal with the state's needs and response to the federal economic stimulus money. Alaska is set to receive more than $800 million. The bill would bring together representatives from the administration, the legislature, and the municipal league to provide a single source of information on the federal response. And sponsor Liesl McGuire says that without a focal point for citizens and policymakers, some of the federal money will slip through the cracks.
My concern is that you have isolated conversations going on with individuals in government, but frankly, people aren't all on the same page. And Alaskans, more importantly, aren't on the same page. They feel like they are out in the dark.
U.S. Senator Mark Begich agrees with McGuire's plan. He says a structure such as McGuire has proposed is needed, in part for getting the money, but also for tracking the money as it is spent. He says accountability is a key component of the federal plan.
It's going to be critical that the executive branch and the legislative branch of the state government be very aware of the dollar expenditure, the job creation, and the capacity of how they use the money. So I think it is a good idea.
The task force would be made of 3 House and 3 Senate members, a representative of the Alaska Municipal League, and 3 members of the administration. McGuire says the idea of setting up the group is not critical of the work that any of the separate analysts are doing. She says it is merely a way of bringing people together.
Our delegation is hard at work. I know that the governor's branch is hard at work. There are members in this building hard at work. But we need to bring the efforts together and have a focal point. And so often in this building, things get complex. And when you're dealing with almost $1 trillion in federal spending, and many of those millions coming to Alaskan projects, we need a task force.
Begich says the oversight will give the needed layer of accountability, but also it will assure Alaskans that the state is looking at every possible component that is available.
I mean, $1 billion coming to the state of Alaska potentially over 24 months is a sizable amount, the largest amount that I've seen in many, many years in a concentrated effort. And that's on top of the other dollars that we will be bringing to the state of Alaska through the normal budgeting process. So I think it is important, and we have a significant level of requirement of accountability by the state of Alaska.
Begich points out that there are other projects that will help Alaska's economy that are not coming through the state government, such as the Native Hospital in Nome and particularly a large block of military projects across the state. McGuire's bill has not yet been scheduled for committee action. Many of Alaska's mid-sized communities will miss out on some of the transportation money from the massive economic stimulus package. Anchorage will get its money, but communities with between 5,000 and 200,000 residents were left out of formula funding. Alaska's congressional delegation is calling it a mistake and an oversight. Alaska was supposed to get an exception from language that requires a certain amount to be spent in small communities. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Local transportation officials in Fairbanks thought they'd receive about $5 million through the stimulus formula funding, but they've now learned that's not the case. Roger Wetherell with the State Department of Transportation says they're not alone.
This is not a Fairbanks issue solely on Fairbanks, but it applies equally to other areas such as the Mat-Su, the Kenai Peninsula, Juneau, Kodiak, Sitka, and even Ketchikan.
The state can decide what to do with about 70% of the stimulus transportation money, but Fairbanks is doubly out of luck because in plans released by state transportation officials this week, none of the money is going to Fairbanks road projects. Fairbanks Borough Mayor Jim Whitaker says the situation can still be salvaged if the state decides to send some of its discretionary money to Fairbanks after all.
There is an out. And the out is that the state has essentially 67% of all stimulus funding that it receives for transportation. That money can be spent at its discretion.
The governor's office says they understand the concern and are looking into the problem to see what they can do. The DOT's Roger Wetherill says if the state gets additional stimulus money, those mid-sized communities should be in line for funding. But he says that money won't come unless other states aren't able to use their transportation funds.
What I can tell you is that Fairbanks is currently on a contingent part of a stimulus list, and that applies to other projects too in other Alaska communities that are equally caught up in this formula issue.
Fairbanks Mayor Whitaker was in Washington this week advocating for interior projects. He says regardless of what happens with the state-allocated money, he's hustling to get stimulus grants and funds that will come directly from federal agencies.
A significant amount of money, hundreds of billions of dollars, would be available for a fair, competitive process. And we've tried to put ourselves in a position to compete for that, and the trip has confirmed that indeed we have that opportunity.
In the meantime, Fairbanks representative Mike Kelly says he's concerned about the situation and is looking into it.
That's obviously top of mind with me, so we're tracking it. And, you know, as this thing unfolds, we're going to try to see what we can do to fix or mitigate that, but it's a high concern.
Kelly sits on the House Finance Committee and will be taking a final look at the economic stimulus bill dealing with the transportation projects before it goes to the floor for a vote. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, attorney questions over the indictments in the Kuskokwim 300 theft case.
In all of my years of practicing criminal law, this is the most malicious prosecution I've ever seen.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Alaska senators have introduced a bill that would allow directional drilling to tap oil under the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Republican Lisa Murkowski introduced it on the Senate floor this morning with the support of Democrat Mark Begich. Murkowski says it could end the three-decade-long debate over drilling in the Arctic Refuge.
Now what we have is a technology that has been developed that offers a compromise solution that may allow much of the area's energy to be produced without surface damage or disturbance when wildlife are in the area.
Murkowski says the plan enlists directional drilling technology BP is using at the Liberty oil field on Alaska's North Slope. She says the wellheads can be placed as far as 8 to 10 miles away from the oil supply. Murkowski believes the above-ground entry points can be outside the refuge's boundary on state-owned land or state waters to the north.
It's like an invisible straw that would essentially be able to siphon the oil from under the coastal plain area, provide for the resource that we need without the surface disruption.
Under the bill, royalties from drilling profits would be split between federal and state treasuries, with half of the federal share funding renewable energy. Another 25% would go toward funding fish and wildlife habitat and conservation programs. Murkowski calls it a compromise and says directional drilling should ease the concerns of environmentalists and subsistence users. But environmentalists disagree, and Gwich'in Steering Committee Executive Director Lucy Beach says she will fight it.
Everything that the oil companies have done so far on the North Slope have come with impacts, and this latest scheme would bring many impacts as well. On the surface, it sounds like it's just this simple little procedure that, you know, no one would even notice and wouldn't cause any problems.
But Beach says seismic tests and construction will impact the porcupine caribou herd that the Gwich'in depend on, and she worries an oil spill offshore or on nearby state lands would still harm the wildlife vital to Gwich'in survival. Environmentalist Kristen Miller with the Alaska Wilderness League agrees that ANWR should not be open to drilling, including with directional techniques.
You know, what we're really concerned about is the oil industry has a really disappointing record on Alaska's North Slope. You know, there's been a number of spills as recent as last week. You know, the second largest oil spill in Alaska's history was only in 2006. So we feel that this is not a time that we need to look at new places to drill.
Miller and Beach say they want to see Alaska's congressional delegation focus on renewable energy and encourage conservation of fossil fuels instead of pushing for more drilling. The former manager of the Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race, Stacy Gilliland, has been indicted on 25 criminal counts. Gilliland was arrested last spring and charged with theft involving K300 funds. Her case went to grand jury yesterday. KYUK's Shane Iverson has the story.
All 25 of the counts are listed as Class B or C felonies. They include one count each of theft in the first degree, scheme to fraud, misapplication of property, and there are 22 counts of forgery. The indictment lists activities occurring between April and December of 2007 when Gilliland served as the manager of the Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race. When she was originally arrested last spring, only two charges were brought up. But the prosecutor on the case, District Attorney Andrew Granick, says a second police investigation expanded that evidence.
The initial investigation wasn't sufficient enough for the state to take the case to grand jury without any additional investigation.
In an interview last month, Gilliland said she is innocent of any wrongdoing.
I'm innocent. I've taken nothing from the K-300 organization. It would never occur to me to do so. All I did was work tirelessly.
Her attorney, Sean Brown, says he believes the counts will be dismissed as the case proceeds. He has harsh words for the state's prosecution.
And all of my years of practicing criminal law, this is the most malicious prosecution I've ever seen.
Brown points to the 22 forgery counts. He says those checks represent the compensation she was supposed to receive for her work.
Ms. Gillian was paid a wage by the K-300 for working with them, and the felony counts are based upon the checks that the K-300 paid her. So they allowed her to work for them during 2007 and 2008, and now there's felony counts based upon those checks.
But District Attorney Granick dismissed those accusations. Granick refused to comment on the details of the case, citing concerns that it could lead to a mistrial. But he says his office is handling the case just like any other criminal prosecution.
The charges were originated in this particular incarnation of the case by the state taking the case in front of grand jury and grand jury reviewing the evidence and deciding whether or not the charges are appropriate.
Gilliland is pleading not guilty to all counts. Her next court appearance is scheduled for March 13th. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Anchorage Representative Pete Peterson has requested the Department of Law's input into the federal investigation of price fixing among ocean shipping companies. Peterson says the ongoing criminal investigation is similar to civil litigation now in the Federal District Court in Anchorage. He says the results of the investigation and lawsuit could affect all Alaskans.
If they're keeping their prices fixed, then it's costing everyone more money than it should. And so if this has been going on since the mid-90s, you're talking about, a large sum of money.
He is preparing for the Energy Committee meetings this weekend in Dillingham, and he plans to ask rural residents about the effects of having a single source for fuel and other goods.
People in rural areas that, have no choice but to buy from maybe one company, if that company that's shipping it to that company is charging extra, then it just passes a larger bill on to them than what they are already paying. And so with no competition, or very little competition, it makes it much easier to charge whatever they can get away with, so to speak,
In a reply to Peterson's inquiry, Acting Attorney General Rick Svobodny wrote that the Department of Law has been monitoring the issue for several months and understands its importance to Alaskans. However, he says state law requires him to keep the subject confidential, even as to whether there is an ongoing investigation.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
Today is the 100th anniversary of the first National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. Some of the first areas to be added to the system were Bogsloff Island near Unalaska, St. Matthew Island, and Walrus Island. President Theodore Roosevelt designated them as bird reserves. In 1980, these lands were consolidated with others to create the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, which encompasses 2,500 islands and rocks along Alaska's coast and includes most of the Aleutian Islands. The refuge protects habitat for more than 40 million seabirds. The Maritime Refuge will host celebrations throughout the state this summer. The federal stimulus legislation may help rural Alaskans Alaska upgrade broadband service for faster internet connection, but organizations need to be ready to act quickly. That was the message of a teleconference organized yesterday by the University of Alaska and the Institute of the North. President of Palmer-based Alex Hills Associates, Dr. Alex Hills, was the discussion moderator and said around 1% or $7.2 billion of stimulus funds have been allocated for broadband deployment. Dr. Hills says high-speed internet is important in America because the U.S. is behind other countries, about 15th for broadband speed.
And far behind nations like Japan and Korea in the availability of broadband or high-speed internet services. So this particular part of the stimulus package is aimed at trying to remedy that situation by making grants available to various kinds of organizations to increase the speed of the internet service, to build new facilities, and so on.
Hills repeatedly stressed the importance for education organizations, telecommunication companies, and tribal organizations to get busy building their applications now. Even though the rulemaking process could be delayed till the spring or summer, funding awards must be made by September 2010, which leaves just a year for submissions and review.
There's a good chance that the agencies will, if they delay, then they may take that out on the proposers in terms of requiring some fairly short deadlines for the submission of proposals. So that's another reason why we in Alaska need to act quickly, get ready, and when the guidelines come out, then be able to quickly put their proposals together so they can be submitted under what may be a fairly short deadline.
Hill says high-speed connectivity is increasingly important because it is tied to how people engage in modern society. He says building economies in rural Alaska will rely on broadband deployment to aid that commerce. He says in the 1970s, there was a big push to get basic telecommunications into remote Alaskan communities.
And now we have another opportunity to get modern telecommunication services, which translates to broadband internet, and to make that available throughout the rural parts of the state. So I'm really hoping that we can take advantage of that opportunity.
The Stimulus Act requires 75% of the broadband funding go to rural areas with insufficient internet speed. More information is at our website, aprn.org. Alaska's avalanche season is underway, and Alaska state troopers are hoping to raise awareness of the dangers of mountain backcountry travel. Beginning tomorrow, troopers are sponsoring avalanche workshops in Seward, Talkeetna, Fairbanks, Glen Allen, and Sitka. The majority of avalanches that involve injuries or death are triggered by snow machines, skiers, and snowboarders. In Juneau, backcountry users can practice their avalanche rescue skills at Eagle Crest Ski Area's new Avalanche Beacon Training Park. The mobile unit was purchased with the idea that it could be used for training in other parts of the southeast region. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander visited the park with Eagle Crest snow safety directors and got a primer.
When you're out in the backcountry, your friend gets caught in a slide and he's buried. That's not the time you want to get the instruction book out and start to wonder, now how does this work?
Eagle Crest ski patrolman Dale Gosnell has seen it happen before. Backcountry enthusiasts buy the right gear, but don't know how to use it.
It's important to have an avalanche transceiver, an avalanche probe, a shovel, and the skill to use those things, and also a companion who also has those tools and those skills.
After 2 weeks of sun that belied spring, it's a windy, snowy day at Eagle Crest. Gosnell and Snow Safety Director Brian Davies know that skiers and snowboarders will be heading out of bounds this weekend. They hope they stop at the Avalanche Beacon Training Park before they cross the rope line. The so-called Easy Search is mounted on a pole beside Raven Runout at Cropley Flats. It's powered by efficient lithium batteries recharged by a solar panel above. Six radio-controlled units, each about the size of a small briefcase, are buried beneath the snow in an area about the size of a soccer field. Those pads simulate buried victims wearing an avalanche transceiver. This is the place to practice using the gear that's required for safe backcountry travel. The machine has three search modes, each with increasing difficulty. Davey sets it on easy, and it indicates that one avalanche victim is buried somewhere in the area.
Going to get your probe ready.
He turns on his transceiver. Gosnell makes sure his transceiver is off.
Otherwise, you're kind of looking for each other.
Avalanche transceivers send out electromagnetic flux lines in every direction. Searchers follow those signals to the beacon that's transmitting from the buried victim. Davies and Gosnell start hiking through the heavy snow. Cropley Flat soon begins to feel like a big place. Davies hikes in one direction, then another. Still no beeps from his transceiver. Then his pace quickens, and it appears he has a signal. He stops and probes deep into the snow and hits soil. Again and again he probes. His transceiver tells him he's getting closer to the victim.
I'm just kind of probing outward in a circle, giving about 10 centimeters between each probe strike.
He reaches the victim, and behind him the easy search is beeping. A yellow light is flashing. If this had been a real avalanche, the chances of surviving decreased dramatically after 15 minutes. It took Davies just over 11 minutes. In a real-life situation, the next step is digging out the victim.
Statistically, the average burial depth in the United States is 8/10 of a meter. So just shy of 3 feet, or right about 3 feet. They say the average time to move a cubic meter or a cubic yard of snow 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet is about 10 minutes. If you are doing a multiple search, none of the beacons turn off until you've found them all, so it makes you think, because you can't turn off somebody's beacon until they've been excavated out of the snow.
The Avalanche Beacon Training Park is funded by a $15,000 grant from the Alaska Search and Rescue Association, or ASARA. The park is a collaboration of Eagle Crest, National Ski Patrol, Juneau Mountain Rescue, Sea Dogs, and ASARA. JMR's Doug Wesson wrote the successful grant for the Rugged Portable Unit, which can be used for training by mountain rescue groups throughout Southeast Alaska. Alyeska Ski Resort in Girdwood also has an easy search. Eagle Crest Snow Safety Director Davies says there's no substitute for practice if you're traveling in the backcountry.
Yeah, we have a pretty adventurous community that like to get out and about. And unfortunately, I coined a phrase of maritime complacency. Our snowpack kind of leads us into getting away with a lot of stuff. But when it does go, it tends to go pretty big. And we don't want anybody hurt. We want people to be out there and enjoy. So come practice.
In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.